This is The End User, episode 190 for Thursday, January 22nd. If the Trident broke, don't fix it. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr. And, I guess it's kind of a big week for the future, Chris, because we got to hear some new details on the future of Windows.
Yes, and I just want to mention that we skipped last week because we had some scheduling mishaps, and luckily not a whole lot happened, so we're not missing out on a whole lot. But you're right, we've got we wrapped up CES last week. I thought we were going to get a little more news out of it, but I think we pretty much covered it. And we're talking all about Windows 10 and a few other announcements from Microsoft in an event that happened today, January 21st. So people seem very excited about what Microsoft is putting out there.
Yeah, I was definitely following along as much as I could, and we already knew that Microsoft was going to skip Windows 9 and go right to Windows 10, but their big new announcement this week was an experimental concept called Windows Holographic.
Yeah, so do you want to lead off with the HoloLens, as they called it?
Sure, we could. I mean, this is definitely the most exciting thing for me. There was actually a great story in Wired that had a chance to demo the technology a few months ago and is only now able to talk about it. But Microsoft has been working on this project since the beginning of the Kinect technology for Xbox. It has sort of evolved into something like this, which is basically an augmented reality interface, as I understand it.
Yeah, so there's a little bit of confusion because in some of the examples they gave, it was nearly virtual reality, but in the example they gave, they had scientists with data from the Mars rover, Curiosity, and they were basically in a room that had things projected on the side of it, as I understand it, on the walls. So it really was it really is augmented reality, but at first I was a little confused that it somehow straddled the two of them. But yeah, in reality, it really is augmented reality. So it's more like Google Glass on steroids. So the idea is that you wear this rather large headset, and they can project various bits of data onto whatever thing in 3D space around you that it can. So, for example, one of the clips they showed, which I thought, frankly, was kind of crazy, was that there was a guy in his kitchen, and he had a soccer game on a virtual TV on the wall while he was doing some other things with it. So it kind of, in your own visor, it projects images onto walls and objects around you and into free space in front of you. So one of the other examples they had was they had an app where you could build little things and then take them to the 3D printer. So they had an example of a quadcopter that they had built and printed, apparently. But it seems a little bit complex to me. I'm surprised by that. But that was the demo they gave, at least.
Right. So it's a fully immersive technology. So it's able to display things that occupy a physical location in your field of vision. So it can display anything anywhere. And so that if that guy is watching soccer on the virtual TV, it stays put as he moves his head around the room.
Right.
Another really interesting application that I thought is that it can also be virtual reality. So you can use this prototype headset to trick your eyes into thinking that you're, for example, on Mars looking around the Curiosity rover, which is one of the scenarios that they previewed for Wired. And indeed, it's something that NASA has already signed up in a partnership with Microsoft to enable.
Yeah, and that's a question that I think is still kind of outstanding. You know, a lot of the journalists got to do the demo today where they were able to actually use it. But You know, I'd imagine if you're in a fully immersive environment like that, using this augmented reality headset, if, you know, you would end up bumping into the wall eventually.
Yeah, well, it seems to me that unlike Google Glass, which is supposed to be...
It's purely...
It's small enough, and it's very non-invasive that you can wear it around wherever you are, you know, in public, on the train, when you're driving. But with this technology as it is right now, it's not something you'd want to wear outside of a home or a dedicated workspace.
Yeah, and they had an example of somebody walking down a hallway at a business or something like that and Skyping with somebody while they were walking around. And I don't think that that is in reality.
It's definitely in reality, and I think Google Glass can do that. It's also a terrible idea.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It just doesn't seem like that is something somebody would want to do. I saw that Harry McCracken, the technologizer, tweeted and a very good point where if two people are Skyping with this HoloLens device, then do you get a video of each other wearing this big ridiculous visor? I guess you would.
A video or some sort of avatar stand-in.
Yeah, you wouldn't get the, you know, front-on webcam kind of view that you'd think you would get.
Right.
So yeah, for a pretty good reason, I think, this is the device that has really captured the imagination of the tech press. I happen to think that it may not be successful as a consumer product, but I could see it be successful for the education market, you know, virtual classrooms and that kind of thing. And I could see it be kind of successful somehow in some kind of gaming situation, you know, something where you're doing something where you're standing relatively still, but you can still take advantage of all of the kind of projections. But as far as this, like you said, being worn around outside, you know, I don't think that is going to work out so well. And as far as being a straight-up consumer technology device, I'm not sure it really has a place.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. I think the interface has a long way to go, and they have no idea what people are going to start building for this when they're able to do so. So far, it does look like virtual reality devices of this type, when they're ready for the market, will initially be confined to, you know, someone who's sitting in a swivel chair or maybe you know, not walking around, because you don't want to do that. Although the Microsoft HoloLens does have the ability to be used in an actual immersive space, unlike Oculus Rift or Samsung's Gear VR, that are necessarily a fully immersive experience where you can't and don't walk around while you're using it.
Right. So this has a little bit of both in it, which makes it quite interesting.
It makes it interesting in certain applications, but I don't think at this stage in the technology that people are going to want to walk around their house watching virtual TVs when it's cheaper to just get a TV.
Right. Well, and I think there are some kind of specialized applications where this would be really cool. So, like I mentioned, education would be one. Anything where, like, I think of, like, instructing people on how to weld something, where you can see their field of vision, and you can draw in front of them, right? I feel like there's a ton of industrial applications that could possibly be very useful for.
Yeah, and even simpler things like being able to conduct simple home repairs can be directed and tutored in real time using the HoloLens.
Yeah, and that was the big example they gave in their presentation, was somebody was replacing the trap underneath a sink. So
those are really cool applications, but I don't think it's going to be a killer app in this case.
No, not for the consumer, at least. You know, looking at the vast consumer market, I just don't know where this fits in. But I can kind of see what they're after, but I'm just not sure it fits in as a consumer product.
Yeah, they're after something that is many years down the road, but this is a good start.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, this is really born out of their research and development lab, and it is exactly that. It's going to need some years, I'd imagine, to really mature.
I'm sure it will. But the first pieces of Windows 10 will be getting this year, and they will probably be a lot less expensive.
Yeah, so this is kind of crazy from a Windows release perspective, but Microsoft is releasing their next version of Windows, which we've mentioned before is going to be called Windows 10 instead of Windows 9. And I think the biggest change from years past in Windows is that they're planning to make this upgrade free for anyone on Windows 7 and up. So what they're saying currently is that you will get Windows 10 for free for a year, and with the implication being that they're moving into some kind of Windows as a service realm where you pay some kind of subscription fee, maybe yearly or something like that. They didn't really release all of the details, and they're still working on the technology of it. They're still, you know, developing the software, but they gave a demo, and they did say that it was going to be free. So that is a massive change for how Microsoft usually does business.
Yeah, it absolutely is. So they have said that it will be free for the first year of sales, and they won't immediately start charging after that. The product that you get will not have an expiration date, but they are clearly, as they've been doing with Microsoft Office and most of their other business lines, is they're moving to more of a subscription model. And the interesting thing here is that they want everyone to upgrade to Windows 10.
Yeah, if you want...
And they are willing to offer legacy hardware support in order to achieve it.
Right, if you want to have people upgrade to this thing, you need to make it easy and you need to make it free. That is pretty much a surefire way to get a lot of older systems onto a new kind of software. So I'm imagining something like what Chrome does, where this is really the last in-place version of Windows that you're going to have. You know, you're going to get it with new devices, obviously, but it seems to me like they're going to charge some kind of subscription fee or something like that, and then it's just going to continuously update in the background, and you're going to have no choice. That way, we don't run into the situation where we have old computers running XP out in the wild with really old and, in fact, dangerous software at this point in time, and it will just kind of update itself, and you just won't notice.
I think that's fine as a business model, and you know, will probably be not much more expensive for most consumers over the long run. But my main concern would be what happens when people start getting automatic upgrades downloaded and something changes to the user interface that affects its usability. You know, what if your hardware can't keep up and suddenly your computer is slow and you didn't do anything? What if they make a design decision that confuses people, you know, like Windows 8 did for a lot of people with the modern UI.
Well, I think the idea is that if you move a little, you move more quickly in smaller steps. So, for example, if they had been doing this all along, Windows 8, which has been kind of a consumer flop, even though I kind of liked it, it never would happen because there would be no one point where you've got this brand new, huge, gigantic thing that people upgrade to and then say, what is this? You know, it's a slow upgrade over time. And that's what Chrome does too, you know, when they introduce things. You almost don't realize how much it has changed over time, but it in fact has changed quite a bit. And I think they're going to try to go after that kind of idea.
Well, I think that's uncharted territory for Microsoft.
It is,
As much of a consumer dud Windows 8 has been, the big dramatic change is what Microsoft tends to do with their software. Like, they come out with something new, and it's new, and that's a feature, not a bug. And Google has always done incremental changes, and so that makes sense for their business model. But to see Microsoft adapt their products to that kind of development schedule, I think will be a very dramatic shift more so than anything that we've seen from or heard from Satya Nadella since he took over.
Yeah, I think so. I think that is the magnitude of what we're talking about. Is, you know, I don't know if they're going to go whole hog into this with, you know, the first release of Windows 10. Obviously, they have to get it out there first. But I think that's kind of the big idea that they're getting after, is that they're going to start doing these smaller incremental updates.
All right. Well, I guess it remains to be seen. But if Microsoft can pull it off, it will be a big change for the company.
Also, updating anything is still relatively painful when it comes to operating systems, right? I mean, I barely notice when Chrome updates, and I just realize that, you know, something changed at some point, and it's really, really seamless. And to achieve success with this kind of model, you have to have it be seamless. If somebody really notices that you've made an update of some sort, then you've lost the battle.
Right, but that is not something that Microsoft's going to have to worry about for a year or so.
Yeah, not for
some time. I mean, they definitely have
time
to start planning for it now, but they won't have to implement it.
Right. Yeah, they won't have to. They'll get there eventually, but we'll have to see what happens. And I am speculating a little bit too, so we'll have to kind of see what happens with them going toward the future.
All right, but meanwhile, with the initial free upgrade release of Windows 10, what are some of the other things that we're going to get?
Right. So now on this podcast, we haven't talked about a lot of the Windows 10 rumors that have been going about. It turns out pretty much everything that we saw leaked did actually come true. We've got a kind of reworked desktop environment for laptops and desktops, where the desktop is pretty much coming back to how it used to be, where it boots up and you have a taskbar at the bottom and you have a desktop with a recycle bin in the upper left. They have reworked the start menu significantly. Now, it is an actual menu. It doesn't pull up a big screen of tiles like it does in Windows 8. And what they've done is they shoved all of the tiles off to the right of the start menu. So it has some elements of Windows 8 in it with the live tiles in the start menu, but it has some elements of Windows 7 with the kind of traditional menuing system and the traditional windowing system too. When you're in desktop mode, this thing is intended to be used with Windows, not these full screen Windows 8 style apps. So then if you've got a hybrid device like the Surface Pro, when you snap the screen off of the keyboard, it will ask you if you'd like to go into tablet mode. And if you say yes to that, it will no longer allow you to tile the windows, and you have to use the full screen apps in a more Windows 8 kind of way. So I think that's a pretty good compromise. It seems like they've done a lot to kind of work on that desktop experience. One thing that I was a little struck by as not being such a good experience is in tablet mode, you still have a taskbar at the bottom, which I think is hugely distracting. I couldn't imagine sitting down and using an iPad or something like that and having a taskbar with a start button on the bottom of the screen. So that seems a little weird. I guess Android does a little bit of that with all of their soft buttons at the bottom, but nothing like
that. Well, but those
are
different. Those are very minimal and highly functional to the particular software that you're using.
Yeah. So I thought that was a little wacky from a user experience perspective. But the upgrades on the desktop and laptop side, I think, are huge ones, and I think people will get along with this version. But I feel like they're souring the tablet side of things a little bit.
I think so. They may have to do some further revision there.
Yeah. All right. So another cool feature that they're adding to Windows 10 is Cortana. So we've talked about Cortana before. It's like Siri is for the iPhone, but that is what was on Windows Phone. It's the virtual assistant deal. So they're actually going to start baking this into Windows itself. So if you ask Cortana something, it pops up a little menu by the start menu and gives you a similar view that they call notebooks. And this is the same thing on Windows Phone. So pretty much everything you'd expect from Cortana integration if you're familiar with Cortana on Windows Phone. It's pretty much all there on Windows. So this goes for, as far as I can see, all versions of Windows 10, including business versions. So I wonder if businesses will like people talking to their computers or not. I made the joke on Twitter that you'll have to ask Cortana if your coworkers can overhear you before you actually have a conversation with her. But seriously, what is actually cool about this? I can't imagine sitting down at my desktop with my keyboard in my hands and asking the computer questions. That seems ridiculous. But what the use case that I envision for this is just leaving your computer open on a coffee table somewhere and yelling questions at it sometimes.
Sure. I mean, the computer, you know, a computer that's always on that you leave on a table somewhere has the ability to do more precise active listening, right? It can leave its microphone on and filter through all that sound without wasting as much energy as a smartphone would. I mean, there are some smartphones that do that. Notably, the Moto X has had Google Now on constant or always on voice activation, but it's not a feature a lot of people use because it eats up a lot of battery. But that wouldn't be such a problem for a laptop.
Yeah, and I just feel like in the same vein as getting the Amazon Echo, which we've talked about before, it's kind of cool to just have a device that you could randomly throw a question at if you're doing something else. Or you could imagine this thing, you know, you're playing, controlling your music somehow through it, and you can tell Cortana to pause the music and stuff like that.
Right. And what would be even better is if you could use your Windows phone to activate Cortana and tell it to do something on the computer.
Yeah, yeah. So there's plenty of use cases for that. Among them is not sitting at the computer using a keyboard and mouse. I feel like that in that situation, it doesn't make a lot of sense. So another one is the Microsoft has pretty much rewritten Internet Explorer from the ground up. They're calling this Project Spartan, and it was a little unclear if they were going to keep the old Internet Explorer around for legacy purposes and then add Spartan on top of it. That's the impression that I got. But
the impression that I got is they always keep the old Internet Explorer around for legacy purposes.
True.
And apparently because no one wants to upgrade Internet Explorer.
Yeah, because it always breaks stuff. Because
that's no excuse to use IE6, Chris.
Well, right. And you get into some businesses have situations where they have a lot of money invested into applications that only work in IE6. So they want to support those kind of scenarios. But for consumers, I don't see there's no reason to be using an old browser.
Absolutely not. But what's the reason to be using Microsoft's new browser?
Well, they've rewritten the browser engine, like the whole thing from soup to nuts. And so I'd imagine that it's going to be more compliant with all of the HTML5 standards and that kind of thing. So, and actually, Internet Explorer 11 is pretty good at that. Like, I would expect all of the internet to work perfectly in Internet Explorer 11, just like it would in Chrome or Firefox. But I definitely can't say the same if you're roaming around with IE8 or something like that, or even previous to that. I wouldn't expect the entire internet to work. I'd imagine they're bringing the core of the browser up to snuff with a lot of the kind of more recent web standards that are happening. Now, they've also kind of redone the user experience of the browser. So it's a little more minimal. You've got tabs at the top, just like Chrome. You've got a bar underneath the tabs, and that's it. And the rest is the web page. And
I mean, I like that they're trying to get rid of their Chrome. That's something that Internet Explorer has had problems with for a long time, but I'm still a little skeptical here. I mean, Internet Explorer 11 works pretty well with most websites. Okay, good. At this point, Chrome and Firefox and Safari and Opera are competing to say, we have the most features, we're the fastest. Apple just invented a new type of JavaScript rendering that crunches instances of JavaScript 5 times as fast as anyone had ever done it before. You know, Opera is now offloading almost all website rendering off outside of the computer and minimizing data usage. Chrome is making advances every week that people don't know about it, but it always makes your browser faster and it doesn't ever break anything. Internet Explorer 11 is good enough, and Spartan is entirely redesigned and slightly better. I just don't understand, you know, and I didn't watch the whole Windows 10 event, and I don't have all of the details, but I'm not seeing any of those killer features.
Well, so they did add something, if you want a more consumer-facing feature, because I'd imagine that they're trying to get Internet Explorer to be on par with Chrome with this kind of redesign. That I bet, is their objective. But here's one. So they introduced this the sharing feature where you could you'd click a button of some sort and it would put it into sharing mode, and then you could draw on the web page and then share it off with somebody. They've also added Cortana into the browser search bar. So it's not Cortana like the virtual assistant kind of Cortana. It's more like Google Now. So for example, if you search for a flight number, it will drop down right below the address bar the flight information for you. So it does a lot of that kind of meta lookup business. And those are definitely new. I haven't seen those in previous versions of IE for sure. And last one is a special reading mode where it will smartly pick out the text on the web page and remove all of the Chrome off to the side, you know, the sidebars and that kind of thing. And then it will cache it so that you can read it offline later. So it's almost like a readability thing.
Okay, but all of those features are just playing catch up from other browsers who have had that for years.
Yeah, everything but the sharing feature, I'd say yes to. But that sharing feature is pretty much unique as far as I see.
And I'm guessing it's only going to work with other people who use Spartan.
Yeah, that's probably true. I'd imagine that's true.
Which means that no one's going to use it.
So it says in the article we're sharing in the show notes that Spartan is also based upon the rendering engine Trident, which is what IE11 is based off of. So now I'm even more confused. I was under the impression from watching the event that they had rewritten Trident in an effort to catch up to some things that Chrome is doing that IE was not able to do. So I'm not even sure about that.
If the Trident works, don't fix it.
Right. Okay, I think we'll do one more Windows 10... two more Windows 10 things, and then we'll move it along. I know we're front loading this podcast, but this is the new Microsoft, and I feel like it's very exciting to see what they're doing. This is make or break time for them.
This is the big news of the week for sure. I want to know more about Windows 10. I want to know about Spartan. I want to know about Cortana and, you know, Windows holograms and things.
Yeah, I don't think they gave us a date, but there definitely will be a preview that you'll be able to play around with in a virtual machine or something if you were so inclined. Okay, so they also, on stage, they had a TV whose sole purpose was to display the Microsoft logo. And then toward the end of the event, they decided to talk about the next thing. And that thing was, in fact, the TV that everybody had been staring at, which had only been displaying a logo up until then. And it's an 84-inch 4K touch display with a pen input that's aimed at businesses. And they're calling this the Surface Hub. And it's basically a kind of telepresence device, and along with a whole lot of more sharing kind of features. But it's a TV that has Windows 10 baked into it and has teleconferencing capabilities built into it, presumably via Skype. And they have a bunch of sharing kind of features where anybody can take the screen and draw on it and that kind of thing. So it's
got it. So their target market is 24-hour cable news networks.
Yeah, probably.
That's who's going to be using this thing. We see it on MSNBC within the month.
Yeah, and Will I Am.
Oh no, he's hologram only. He's not going to use anything like this.
Right.
He's got his own tech company now.
Yeah, he does. That's right. So anyway, that really targets businesses, so I'm not sure we'll get a whole lot into it, but there's a lot of really compelling technology in that device, and I imagine it's going to be very, very expensive, but it seemed, from their demo, it seemed like a very cool way to talk to one another with people who are located remotely.
Yeah, it's obviously amazing technology. I mean, it's an 84-inch super high-definition display. It can do pen input. It can do voice input. It has camera input. It has microphones everywhere. It's going to be amazing technology for those businesses that can afford it, which I have to imagine will mostly be not the businesses that can afford it, but the businesses that want to show it off.
Right, right. Okay, Taylor, so I've got one more for you. There was also a whole segment that they did on gaming. They're bringing an Xbox app for Windows, which almost looked like kind of the Microsoft version of Steam. Now, they also showed off Steam, so I'm not sure they're even trying to compete, but you're going to be able to play some Xbox games on Windows 10 directly, and as well as run Steam if you want to do that. But here's the really cool thing. That's fine, you know, okay, that's fine. But here's the really cool thing. So if you have an Xbox One in the household, you can stream games from the Xbox One to an arbitrary Windows 10 machine.
I actually love this. I think it's an amazing feature. That's really cool.
Isn't that great? So you could potentially, if you wanted to, for whatever reason, have a tablet, and you could actually play the real version of Forza on it with a real controller hooked up via Bluetooth to the tablet, and it would just stream to the tablet. I'm still racking my brain for the use cases, but I feel like there have to be some.
Yeah, I mean, I think anything that Microsoft can do to integrate Windows 10 and the Xbox One is going to be a win for them, a huge win.
Yeah, so that was pretty cool news. So let's round out the event. I wanted to mention one more thing before we move on into our the rest of our top news.
And that's a performance by U2?
No, and there's
I forgot what kind of event this was. I lost track there.
Actually, it's funny that you mention it because the very last thing they did is they demoed the HoloLens, and this guy walks off the stage and it's just like silent for a minute for a second. And it just seemed like that was the perfect place. Like just drop the microphone and leave and be like, yeah, you saw that, you know, that was some AR and VR technology that just blew your mind. But then they had Satya Nadella, the CEO, come out and, spout some kind of, business speak vision for the company. So I thought that was a little weird. It was the perfect exit if they had just ended it right there, but they brought him out for one last segment.
I guess they're still getting the hang of the showmanship thing.
Yeah, but overall, I think just judging from the press media's reaction, it's been, people are impressed by this, and people are viewing this as a new road for Microsoft. So I want to say one last thing before we get out of the event news, and that is...
Is it a performance by U2?
No, it's a free album by U2 from Microsoft to you.
Oh, do not want.
No, it's not that. We forgot to mention at the top that the HoloLens, the so-called holographic visor, is in fact has nothing to do with holograms. Holograms are things that you project externally so that people can see them, not something that you have to wear a visor for.
Right, that's true.
It's strictly augmented reality and in a more limited sense, virtual reality, but it has absolutely nothing to do with holograms or holographs in any way whatsoever, other than it gives one person the illusion of a hologram. So they're basing their entire product off of kind of a falsehood.
Well, I mean, they're calling it HoloLens, which, you know, that's the name of the product. So it's sort of implying holography, but not quite. And, you know, maybe in the future they'll invent a holographic projector and Windows will run on that.
Yeah, maybe. But that's that's a stretch.
Is it? I don't know. They just came out with an 84-inch super high-def TV that can read everybody's words and expressions in the whole room.
Yeah, true. Yeah, I'm just a little baffled by them going with something that is not the thing it purports to be. That's just a little confusing. And I feel like we're going to get into a Xerox situation where this kind of technology going forward will just be known as hologram from now on.
Oh, it won't be that long till we have real holograms, Chris.
Yeah, true. Okay, so let's move out of the Windows event and let's move on into some of the more some of the other top news that's been happening around. We've really only got one, although the one is a pretty is quite a bit of news. And this is that HP has announced a bunch of new devices. So there are seven devices that they've announced. We will not go through all of them here, but we'll kind of take the pick of the litter. There were a couple that were education specific, and there was one that was healthcare worker specific. But as far as the consumer devices go, we've got the HP Pro Slate 12, which is a $569 12.3-inch KitKat device running Android, obviously, and that's got a 1600 by 1200 pixel screen. So that is one large tablet, Taylor.
It's pretty big, yes. They even have to, they seem to have a sort of notebook that goes with it.
Yeah, and I think I there are probably a bunch of people out there that want a tablet but kind of miss the big old screen of a notebook. I mean, some notebook devices are up to like 17 inches. So I can definitely see that some people might want this.
Yeah, and we've seen a few tablets that are even bigger than 12 inches,
Yeah, that's
although
true.
they have not sold well because they were not made by well-known companies, and they were not made well, and they were ridiculously large and clunky. But the weirdest thing to me so far about the Pro Slate 12 is that it is branded as HP. The only logo that you will see on it is HP, but the stylus that comes with it says Hewlett Packard. And it's the Slate's little brother, the Pro Slate 8, says Hewlett Packard and not HP. Now, I'm sure that this is a, some legacy design decisions that happened because it was very recently that HP split into two separate companies.
Yeah,
There's
sure, you're right.
Hewlett Packard, the consumer computer products company, and I think it's HP Corporate Solutions that does, well, you can figure it out.
So you mentioned there the Pro Slate 8, which says Hewlett Packard on the back. That's a $449 7.8-inch device. It's got a screen of 2048 by 1536, and is also running KitKat. So yeah, it's just kind of its little brother. But they seem like they're running Snapdragon 800, so it's not the bleeding edge processor in these things, but it's just one behind, really. And if as long as they don't screw up KitKat by customizing it too much, these devices look pretty compelling. But they are missing that sweet spot size that the iPad is. They've straddled it. They've got one that's larger and one that's smaller.
Yeah, that's right.
So maybe they're just giving up on that category in the first place. I don't know.
And it's worth noting that these are widescreen aspect displays as well, which I still think it makes it awkward to use vertically at that size.
Yeah, I think you're right. That was borne out by the after we were able to use the Surface for a while, that screen, the having the ability to turn the screen sideways on the Surface was always awkward because it was just so wide.
Well, it's not that strange, and that's generally the convention for Android tablets. So it looks pretty nice. These both look like pretty nice, competent hardware. The price is reasonable.
Yeah. So up next is the Pro Tablet 408, and that beautifully named device is $299. It's an 8-inch Windows device. It's got a screen at 1280 by 800, and it's got the Intel Atom chipset inside of it. So it's basically a lower end Windows tablet, and we know that devices of this size, the manufacturer gets to buy Windows 8 with Bing, is what they're calling it. They get that operating system for free.
See, now I'm a little confused, though, because this is, it looks smaller, it's plasticky, it looks like a very low build quality, and this is running Windows. So they've come out with a very nice business tablet running Android and a very cheap, to my eye, not particularly well-designed Windows tablet.
Yeah, I think it's like their first, they've had Windows tablets before. In fact, you remember they were the one of the original companies that was doing tablets even in the Windows 7 era. Remember the HP Slate?
I do, yeah.
Yeah, and actually that device was handsome, unlike this one. This is, I think you're right, this is definitely on the lower end. Now, I mean, you got to keep in mind, it's a $300 tablet. It's toward the low end. I mean, I know there are Android tablets that get even cheaper than that, but this is definitely intended to be on the low end of things. So I wouldn't imagine you'd see, you know, an aluminum back and those kind of premium things that you'd see on the higher end tablets.
Okay, fine, but stop creating these custom low-end bespoke products that no one will buy. Take a hint from HTC's playbook. I mean, they clearly did, because the Pro Slate 12 and the Pro Slate 8 basically both look like giant HTC One phones.
Yeah.
And what HTC did with the One is they released it for Android, and then they took the same phone and they released it for Windows.
Yeah, I'd definitely like to see more manufacturers just do that. So also, you have to go and kind of re-engineer the device to release a different Windows version. It would be nice to just say, I want that and I want it with Windows, or I want that and I want it with Android. That would be really nice.
Right, okay, re-engineer the device, but make the outside look the same, please.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so maybe this last one will float your boat, Taylor. This is the Elite X2 1011. And HP has wizardry in their naming department, just like most PC manufacturers do. But this is a kind of premium Ultrabook-style convertible laptop. Not laptop, a convertible kind of like the Surface. So what you have is you have a base that is the keyboard, and it acts as a dock, and you have the tablet that plugs into the dock. So it's pretty much exactly like the Surface Pro, but I feel like the bottom keyboard is a little more substantial on this, just from looking at the photos. So that's a 11.6-inch screen. It's you get the choice between 720p and 1080p. It runs the Core M chips, and the least RAM you can get is 4 gigs, and you can upgrade that, of course. So it seems of the whole list, I feel like this is the most appealing device on the list of things that we've discussed so far.
I guess the keyboard is kind of appealing in its marketing materials. It vaguely resembles a MacBook Air that can come apart.
Sure, yeah.
So that's kind of fun. If it feels as nice as it looks, it'll probably be pretty nice. But this is a design in search of a purpose.
Do you think, in general, the rip-off screen is lacking?
I think it's got a ways to go, yeah, in terms of improvements.
I'd agree with that.
And I don't see any improvements in this product.
Now, and the thing about this, if you're looking at this and the Surface Pro side by side, this one is a little bit cheaper than the Surface Pro. So it's got that. It looks pretty nice for what it's worth, and it's $899, so it's a little cheap, or at least on the low-end model. So I could see people looking at the Surface Pro and being a little freaked out by the price and maybe getting this instead.
Well, not me, thanks, but I do like that this one says Hewlett-Packard, not HP.
There you go. I think that's their branding going forward, is Hewlett-Packard.
I believe that's correct.
Yeah. So last thing, they've also got, you mentioned that there's also this optional pen, and this thing is kind of cool. It's called the Duet Pen. And what you can do is, of course, you can write on the screen because it's a touch screen, but you can also write on an arbitrary surface. So you could write or draw something on a mouse pad, for example, and it would sync up to the screen in front of you as if it was like a Cintiq pen or something like that. So if that works well, I think that's a pretty cool feature. But I'm a little skeptical that it will, because people have been trying to do this for a long time, and turns out maybe to be harder than we thought.
Yeah. So is the pen sold separately?
Yeah. With some of them, it's mixed. So, in fact, I was quite confused looking through which came with which. But some of them are it's sold separately, and some of them it's included. For example,
right, so
one of the devices even has a slot for the pen.
Well, that's nice, but unnecessary. I think.
Yeah, it's just an extra.
Yeah, it's an extra. I mean, it's kind of cool that you can write on a separate notepad and it'll copy everything over, but most people don't need that.
Yeah, definitely agree. But it's definitely an extra little nicety to have. All right, so Taylor, with that, I think we should turn on our afterburners. Are you ready?
Sure, let me get my seatbelt on.
Strapped in?
Okay, I'm ready.
All right, so why don't you kick us off?
Okay. WhatsApp, the messaging app that was bought by Facebook a while back, is now for the first time offering a web app, WhatsApp, that currently only works in Chrome, and it you also have to have the Android or iOS device to sync it up. So you need to confirm your account through your mobile app, and then you can use it in Chrome.
Right, so it's an additional client. So you still need the app for it to work, but what you can do is you snap a picture of this QR code, and then you can continue your WhatsApp session in the browser after that.
Yeah, which is nice because I use WhatsApp, and right now it's my only messaging app that only goes to my phone. My regular text messages and my iMessages and my Google Voice messages, wow, do I have that many messaging platforms? They all go to multiple platforms, and now WhatsApp is able to go to the web as well as my phone. So if something happens to my phone, or if my phone is just really far away, or it's charging, then I can still read my WhatsApp messages. So that's good news.
Yeah, that's neat. So Plex is arriving for PS4 and PS3 in the United States and Canada, at least. So we've talked about Plex before. It's kind of a media server platform that you can use to consume your media around your home and outside of your home. So what we're talking about is that there's a client for PS4 and PS3. So that's pretty cool to see.
Yeah, very cool.
So Steam is launching a new product that is going to allow you to live stream your gameplay within their application. So they're going up against the likes of Twitch.tv. So it's kind of cool to see that built right into the client that allows you to download and buy games. It's definitely one less step. So that is cool to see from Steam, and hopefully that will pick up some steam. You see what I did there?
Yeah, I see what you did there. That was good.
No, it wasn't.
Steamy Steam. LastPass is launching a new client for OS X on Macs. They had an iOS version and a web version, but they didn't have a native LastPass client for Macs. And this is good news, especially for people who currently use LastPass and weren't able to have native access to it on any Macs that they might have, or if they were holding off on buying a Mac because it didn't have LastPass. But for most Apple users, they're either using Apple's built-in password management system, which is part of iCloud, or the longtime premium front runner for password management for Apple is 1Password, which is still continuing to roll out very new features. But a lot of people use LastPass, and those people who also have Macs will now have an easier time of it.
Yeah, looks pretty cool. So there's one client for Windows, but it's really old and they haven't updated it in a while. So maybe they'll be getting around to doing a Windows version soon. So speaking of Windows, Dropbox has finally arrived for Windows Phone. So this is an app that was not available for Windows Phone previously, and quite the gap between iOS, Android, and Windows Phone was the ability to access Dropbox. I know a ton of people that use Dropbox, so that's definitely good to see Dropbox finally arrive onto Windows Phone.
Yeah, that's great. Just as you are leaving Windows Phone.
That's right. So let's flip off the afterburners. We'll get into the end user stories. And you've got a green tech story for us in a bit. So yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about, I'm transitioning over away from Windows Phone with my HTC 8X. And I actually think I'm going to keep the 8X around and use it as a local SmartThings controller. So I've also, we haven't talked about this either, but I've got a SmartThings home automation system set up now, hooked into 5 lamp modules and a motion detector and one other thing. And I'll probably keep the HTC 8X around just in case somebody isn't me that wants to control the system. They can use this device without any kind of password or anything.
Oh, cool. So will you be able to configure it so that it'll be very easy and obvious how to control something for someone who's just picking it up and doesn't know Windows Phone that well?
Yeah, I mean, you just slide the screen up and there's not much you can do about the launching the app. Automatically or anything that at least that I know of. I haven't really looked into it quite yet, but that's the front runner in, you know, I don't like to just throw away the phone immediately and have it have no value for me, right? It's still a quite capable Wi-Fi device. And I also want to keep my antennas tuned on Windows Phone to see what's going on over there too. You know, it's running the latest version of Windows Phone. I'm hoping it'll get the Windows 10 version of Windows 10 Mobile is what they're calling it. So, you know, I kind of want to keep my toe in the water over there, even though I'm switching over to Android.
Yeah, you absolutely should. And that sounds like a great way to do it.
And also, at any point in time, now I haven't done this, but in theory, I could pop out the SIM card and pop it into the 8X and walk out the door and be just fine.
Yeah, you probably should try that. But, I mean, you have the Nexus 5 now, right?
Yes. So I got the Nexus 5 actually for Christmas. And actually, my wife got the Nexus 9 for Christmas, so we're a Nexus family now, Taylor.
Oh wow! I didn't realize that you had made the full Windows 7 to Nexus line switch.
Well, yeah, because she's switching from the Surface RT to the Nexus 9.
Right.
So that's, in fact, I think that's probably a bigger jump than switching from Windows Phone to Android.
Well, you've had Android before.
Yeah, right.
And has she?
Yes, she has a Android phone.
Oh, okay. So not a huge jump for either of you, but still,
yeah, true.
It's a big adjustment in terms of your workflow. You got to set up these new devices. I always think that's half the fun.
Yeah, it is. It is kind of half the fun. So, my observations have been that I really like what they did from KitKat forward. That was really the user experience enhancement that Android really needed, and I feel like it's pretty much there as far as user experience. It's still not quite as buttery as Windows Phone is, but it's 99% now, and it used to be way less than that. But I feel like that Android has definitely arrived into a better user experience from their rather clunky past user experience. Now, the good thing, of course, that I notice immediately is that there are way more apps available for the Android platform. We always knew that. And, you know, we just mentioned Dropbox was coming to Windows Phone. So, but what is kind of cool about the Nexus 5 is, you know, I use Outlook.com for my email. And Microsoft makes the Outlook.com app for Android, and it's pretty much exactly like the Windows Phone client. So I'm actually quite comfortable using this app instead of the Gmail app. So that's kind of cool.
Cool, that's good. Yeah, I sometimes use the Outlook.com app on my iOS phone. It's probably pretty similar.
Yeah, it's probably quite similar. So the other thing is the Google public transit directions, I don't think were quite as good as the Here maps from Nokia that were originally a Windows Phone only product. And luckily, again, in that case, there is a Here beta app for Android, and I've been using that, and it works pretty well. Now, Taylor, if I had to pick one magic thing about Android, that would be Google Now telling you the amount of time you have until you get home at any point in time.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. But I do have to point out, Chris, as we mentioned on the show, when Here Maps was first announced. It came to market first on iOS.
Right, yeah, it was an iOS and then Windows Phone and then Android, I think.
Right.
Yeah, so other than that, you know, Windows Phone pretty much had all of the apps that I used regularly, so that wasn't really a big deal for me. I pretty much just installed all the same apps again. So the transition has been relatively easy for me, and I honestly don't feel like when I was on Windows Phone I was missing all that much from what I have now. And from what I have now, I'm also pretty happy with it. And I have upgraded hardware, so I've been pretty happy with it.
That's very cool. I'm glad you like your new phone. I'm glad that you're able to so nimbly move between ecosystems.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, there's the one lesson, I guess, is for whatever reason I've lucked out into happening to use the platforms and services that pretty much are on both platforms.
I don't think there was any luck involved in that.
I suppose I do tend to use services that are, I try to stick to more mainstream services so that I have that option, I guess.
Yeah, you like compatibility.
Yeah, definitely. So anyway, I'll be keeping a closer eye on Android, and it's likely that you'll notice it in the podcast, but I'll also still be keeping my eye out on Windows Phone once they release that next update. So that's my story for now, and I think we can move on into your Green Tech Story of the Week.
All right, so this one is pretty interesting in that it is an actual product that is about to launch to market. My Green Tech Stories are sometimes a little out there, but this is a company called Windstream. They make portable wind and solar energy generation systems, generally on small scale, so that they can be packed up and moved around. And they're launching a hybrid wind and solar system that's basically meant for emergency systems where you need power in remote places. It's definitely a premium product for specific segments of the market, but it's a very cool, very light, efficient system that can generate energy through photovoltaic cells and then also use those cells as a way of concentrating wind power for a series of small turbines. So it works if it's windy and cloudy, or if it's nighttime and there's only a little bit of wind, or if there's sun and no wind. And so it's a hybrid system that works in a variety of environments, which is really handy when you need to deploy something like this where there's no other electricity and you're not sure how you're going to get electricity. It's one thing that you can buy.
Yeah, I've long thought that the end game for green power solutions is definitely hybrid systems. Not even necessarily in the same box, but just adjacent and collaborating with one another. So instead of, you know, the one large coal power plant that you have a conglomerate of various green power generation devices distributed across an area. And I feel like this is kind of embodying that, but in a local single product.
Yeah, exactly. And I definitely agree. There are major benefits when looking at larger, small-scale energy grids to including multiple different kinds of renewable energy sources because they scale differently and they can provide different sustained and peak power. It's definitely worth considering and absolutely something that we need to do in the long term. And this is sort of a microcosm of that shows how useful and effective it is, particularly when you can combine sources into a single product and get more reliability out of it.
Yeah, so that definitely seems like a pretty cool solution.
Well, so that's it. It's not something that you or I are going to be able to buy anytime soon, but it is something that is it exists, and it's for some people. And you can check it out on this great Treehugger article.
Cool. So let's get into Tip of the Week, and you've got us covered again. You looking for a laptop?
I'm not currently looking for a laptop, although I'm anxiously waiting to see what Apple comes out with next. I probably won't buy one of those either, but I'm considering it. But Lifehacker shared this great, very extensive comparison chart of laptops from productchart.com. And this thing just has so many different current models of laptops on it. And I know a lot of people out there who are currently looking for laptops or who are thinking about it, and it's hard to know where to start and where you'll end up. But this has lots, you know, you can run through the whole chart and compare each one by one, and it has everything organized by screen size and price. And then it has a bunch of different settings and toggles where you can set the minimum amount of RAM and hard drive, the resolution, the size of the screen, the weight, the CPU, the brand, whether it has a touch screen or a solid state drive. And it's a pretty impressive little chart here that can help you figure out exactly what laptop you're looking for based on specs, price, and screen size and all that.
Yeah, it's a really impressive little web app, and it seems to be pretty up to date. So it's definitely a cool resource to have.
Totally. And another cool resource to have if you happen to be a person who is blind is a new app for the iPhone called Be My Eyes. What it does is you open it up and it will use your phone's camera to send images to someone else who then can describe back to you what it is that they are looking at on your behalf. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that is really a cool idea. And I wonder, so the blind person is presumably wearing headphones and something like that. And I don't know what the workflow is and how useful this would be, but from the perspective of a sighted person who really has no idea what that workflow is, it seems really cool. So I'd love to hear from somebody who actually got some use out of it.
Well, you don't have to know anyone who's visually impaired to use the app. If you have use of your eyes, you can help other users of the app,
yeah,
anonymously.
True.
And it's generally a pretty short-term request, so you can do it in your spare time or just as a way to test it out. It's a sort of crowdsourcing at its best, I think, and it's free. So I just think it's a fun thing to try.
Really cool. Yeah, really cool example of using a relatively simple technology, coming up with a clever way of using it and assisting people that may or may not need assistance. So that's really cool.
It totally is. So if you have an iPhone or an iPad, you should definitely check that out. And we've got one other cool thing this week. It is our kicker.
Space. The final frontier,
it's space.
Taylor.
So what happened is NASA has recently published online what may be the largest single composite photograph that's ever been published. It's 4.3 gigabytes of the sky from the southern hemisphere showing the Andromeda Galaxy and its neighbors in very high resolution, high brightness detail. And I'm not sure who created this video of the panorama, but it is an easier way to look at it since it's difficult for most people to capture a 4.3 gigabyte image on their screen at once.
Yeah, it was.
I
don't think it was NASA. I think it was a third party who put this together and, you know, set it to music. And you do kind of the infinite zoom thing where you look at a star that's way far away and you know that entity you're looking at is something like, you know, a solar system or a star. And, you know, it zooms
in. Or perhaps
in
an entire galaxy or perhaps an entire cluster of galaxies.
Right. So this is the... It kind of pans across with kind of neat music. And
right. It's the only way you can... most people on most computers are going to be able to capture the bigness of this photo, which does a modicum of justice in attempting to capture the bigness of our universe.
Yeah, and this is really not even a comment on the bigness of the universe. It's the bigness of the Andromeda Galaxy, our nearest neighboring galaxy. So you think about this, and it's many, 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 many times this. Hugely, hugely larger than this. And this by itself is incredibly mind-boggling and impressive. So I'm looking forward to the future where we can do the same thing, but with multiple galaxies in view instead of just Andromeda. Wouldn't that be cool?
That would be extremely cool, yeah. But we'll have to have some impressively large screens to capture it.
Oh, yes. We need the we need that Microsoft screen to play this video, stat.
We need a couple of them.
Yeah, we need a triple monitor setup with those new Microsoft screens. All right, well, that will do it for this podcast today. Taylor, if somebody wanted to find you on the internet in some way, how might they say hello to you?
They could hello me on ello.co. I'm at TaylorPhone. At TaylorPhone will also probably direct you to my Twitter page. And that would be another way to reach me. I'm also on Facebook, and I'm on Google+. And if you try to find me on Google+, you'll just go, hello, hello, hello.
It'll just into the echo chamber where there's nobody but photographers. Well, same for me. I think Twitter's the best place to get at me if you wanted to find me. I'm at Chris Hale Barnes, so give me a follow. If you do go over to Google Plus or Ello, I'm also over there, although Twitter's the place to be. So, all right. Well, I think that means it's time to get out of here. So thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. And, of course, you can find more information, including the show notes, over there at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's THENDUSR. The DMZ has a few other podcasts. You should have a listen to Entertainment 2.0 and Home On. You can also send us some feedback. We've got our email. It's theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com. Or you can follow us on Twitter. Together we are at @theenduser. You can join us in the chat room as we record the show live every Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Mock.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.